Under the radar to me means authenticity, not being filtered.
It's a window in on the local stories that touch our lives.
And there's a huge void in the traditional media covering these new faces of Boston.
You may not be looking for a particular story, but when you hear about it, you're engaged.
Under the radar means ahead of the curve.
It's also perspectives. How does this particular story affect a community or a neighborhood?
I'm Callie Crossley. This week, Under the Radar, East Boston said no to the casino, but the campaign has left bitter feelings in the Latino community. And public declarations to the contrary, is immigration reform legislation dead in the water? Plus, immigration is the subject of a new animated comedy series, Is It Funny? Series producer and Family Guy creator and comedian Seth MacFarlane thinks so. Later in the show, Lanyap, our Something Extra segment, will tackle the racial bantering at the center of the Miami Dolphins. Was it a part of the NFL culture, all in good fun, racism, or symbolic of a generational shift on the N-word? Joining me in the studio is Marcela Garcia, a special correspondent at Telemundo Boston and a contributing writer for the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe. Hi, Marcela.
Hi, Callie.
Also with me, Julio Ricardo Varela, digital producer for Al Jazeera America's The Stream and founder of LatinoRebels.com. Hi, Julio.
Hey, Callie.
All right, so let's just dive right on in. East Boston voted no, definitively, on the proposed casino, 56-44% against, but that is not the end of the story. So first, just to bring everybody up to date, now there are folks saying, well, half of it is over in Revere, so let's just move everything in Revere because the people in Revere said yes, and we can have a casino there. Except the people in East Boston say, hello, that's right next door. So it's like being in our backyard, and we said no.
Right.
So I just want to say that Senator Anthony Petrocelli, Petrocelli, who represents both Revere and East Boston, has written this on his Facebook page, and he says it is important that both communities retain host community status, meaning they would both benefit if there was something that came out of this. Again, we point out East Boston said no. So it's a big old mess, Marcel.
Yeah, it's a mess. And it's kind of fascinating, too, because, you know, I've been watching all this story develop, and it's just been fascinating. The one thing that I found really interesting was how when the vote came, people were, or the media had this narrative of like, oh, East Boston said no, like it was a big, big no. But to me, you know, putting everything in context and looking at the background or everything that happened, I think it wasn't so much that East Boston said no or that the East Boston anti-casino forces won so much as Suffolk Downs lost. Because if it hadn't been for Caesars dropping out or being rejected by the Massachusetts Gaming Commission, they would have won.
Like, you think
so? Oh, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
And let's be clear that Caesars had to drop out because the Massachusetts Gaming Commission said they weren't, you know, after they did their investigation, they weren't shaping up as they should be. So that meant that the Caesars name was still on the ballot, but
correct,
they were not the partners.
And to me, that was not to take any credit away for the anti-casino folks and the work that they did, but to me, that was a huge gift that fell into their laps, and they just took it and ran with it.
It was last minute, too.
It was last minute, too. So the momentum was there, and they just took off, and they won. But in the reality of it is that if you take everything and you put it all in context, they were going to lose, and Caesars was going to build a casino in East Boston had they not been rejected by the Massachusetts Gaming Commission. Having said all of that, yeah, they invested a lot of money, Suffolk Downs, you know, more than $2 million, or close to $2 million. And again, compared to the little money that the anti-casino folks had, the narrative, you know, all the elements were there to say, oh, David versus Goliath type of situation. Mm-hmm. But in reality, I don't think it was that, you know, again, not to take any credit from this group, from the folks that were opposed to the casino. But again, Suffolk Downs is not just going to let go. They're not going to let go.
That's true.
They're going to find a way to build it. And in all of my conversations with people that oppose the casino, they were all, you know, kept telling me, and granted, you know, again, remember that this is when they thought they were going to lose. They would tell me, oh, you know, even if we win, even if we, you know, say no, they're going to find a way to build. They're going to find, you know, they're going to appeal. You know, there's going to be a fight in court, blah, blah, blah. And so I'd be like a little, you know, I'm like, you know, how is it going to happen if you guys say no? But, you know, lo and behold, like now they're trying to do Revere only. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't happen, I found it fascinating that John Chesto over at the BBJ, the Boston Business Journal, wrote about a third possible scenario. You know, Suffolk Downs owns the Wonderland site in Revere. Right. So that could also be like a backup, super backup plan for them, you know, if Revere only falls through.
Well, but
and a lot of things need to happen before you getting know, there, I, but it just tells you, you know.
Yeah, no, it's I think the only option that the anti-casino group has is to probably create sort of an Occupy Suffolk Downs movement, because I think Suffolk Downs is not going to go away.
Right.
It's an institution in Boston. You know, there's a fabric to Suffolk Downs, and I just find it hard to believe that it's not going to get built there. And it's, you know, even with the Not in My Backyard, it's just that area of Boston that, you know, when you go, it's a very unique area because you have some very dense populated towns as well there. So I always think of like Revere and Chelsea like almost as extensions of Boston.
Mm.
And it just feels like it's going to happen. And I think if the anti-casino group really wants to step up its game, I mean, they're going to have to probably do sit-ins at the racetrack.
But they only spent $22,000 and they won. Yeah, so that's, I mean, that's why everybody says David versus Goliath, because
right.
that was huge.
Right,
right. But I think Marcella's point about Caesars, I mean, that was the gift that they needed.
And nobody
I mean,
and it saw was, it coming. That's the other thing.
Right, exactly.
Like, it
was a surprise.
Yeah, right. So, again, you see the elements there to see it on those terms, David versus Goliath. But that effect of Caesars dropping had an incredible effect that you can
But let
really
me ask this question, though. So wouldn't it have been more powerful for people who were really in support of the casino to vote for it anyway? I mean, to come out in full force to say, just because Caesars dropped out, I don't care.
But they didn't have time.
You know?
They didn't have time to make that argument.
It said Caesars on the ballot, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and also, you got, at least in the Latino community in East Boston, Caesars was the face of the project, not Suffolk Downs. Nobody knew about Chip Tuttle, who is the CEO of Suffolk, until Caesars dropped out. So there were all these strategic things that were happening, and because of the time, because of the timing, they just couldn't make it happen to their advantage. They couldn't make it work to their advantage. And now there was this story, I don't know if you guys saw it in the Boston Globe, saying or talking to people in East Boston about the possibility of the Revere Casino, mm-hmm. and people were saying, if I had known that the Revere only site, you know, where was a possibility, I would have voted yes, not
right.
no.
And that's- Exactly, so, and that's the whole point. That's the whole point. It's like, where do you want the money to go? And I think that's one of the arguments when people
right.
said, well, if it goes to Revere, you know, the mayor was saying it's not going to go to Boston. In the end, that's what's probably going to happen.
Yeah, and again, the Suffolk Downs people were just not ready for Caesars to drop out. You know,
well,
and they,
nobody. Yeah.
Again, they came out of nowhere. And so when they dropped out, it's like, you know, they were left alone, you know, in the middle of the dance room. They were left dancing by themselves.
All right. Well, I want to talk about, because, you know, everybody, we've just discussed what a lot of people are talking about on the radar with regard to this new move and trying to get folks to think about a Revere casino and moving Suffolk Downs and the whole nine yards. But what's been under the radar, Marcella, is you told me you almost got run out of East Boston.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
Because of the very bad feeling
I
there
now. I was kicked out of East Boston. I was told never to come back again to East Boston.
Because?
Because, you know, the people, there's this deep division that this caused. And people kept telling me, well, the stakes are very high and this is going to change our lifestyle, whether you're for the casino or whether you're against the casino, it goes really deep into, or it taps into your lifestyle. Your kids are going to be affected. Your job prospects are going to be affected, whether you're, you know, for it or against it. And so people are taking it very personally. And with that comes a lot of animosity, a lot of, you know, he said, she said type of conflicts. You know, people you know, accusing each other of all sorts of things. And unfortunately, that is going to last beyond this vote and, you know, well into whatever happens to the community, in years to come. Much in the same way, like people would always refer to when Massport or Logan Airport arrived in East mm-hmm. Boston years ago. It also caused a lot of divisions in the Italian and Italian-American community in East Boston. And so they would say that's going to happen again, that, you know, years to come, there's already two camps pretty much, you know, divided. And like, you are for the casino or you're against the casino. And in years to come, that is going to remain there. Like, you were the one who said this. And unfortunately,
the grudges.
Yeah, it's true.
So how would anyone want to kick Marcella out of anywhere? That's my question, Callie.
Well, they thought she was right. Whoever she was talking to thought she was writing for the other side.
Yeah.
So there she was. So Julio, so what we should remind people is that East Boston is mostly Latino. So when you're talking about a rift, we're talking about a huge rift in the community. And it also, I think, speaks to something else, because if this goes on, and it looks like it's going to go on with this whole Revere and who God knows what else, other twist and turn may come, we're now talking about either undermining political power of this group because it's divided.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you could speak to that, Julio.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And I'm going to take the optimistic view of all this, because I've always believed that wedge issues are what make people more political, whether it's your local school or whether it's your development. Everything's local. So if this is going to mobilize the East Boston community to get more engaged, and I'm not saying that they're not in Boston politics, but, you know, if you look at other parts of the city, there are more politically engaged parts of the city as compared to East Boston. And I think, you know, I'm going to look at this optimistically, and I always say, like, if you want to get engaged, whether you agree or disagree with a position, at least you're involved in the process. At least you're speaking out. At least you're going to public hearings. You know, everyone's busy and everyone, you know, has no time on their hand. But if something you care deeply about is affecting you, you should speak out and do the best that you can do. Now, obviously, who knows where this goes and who knows where these divisions will lead to. But I get excited when I see, you know, the Latino community in Boston waking up on an issue, because that is few and far between. The history of that it's not been a history of, I would say, deeply committed political engagement.
And, you know, just to a last comment, before the vote, I predicted that the East Boston turnout was going to be higher, because people were going to come out and vote for the casino, not for the mayoral election. They were not engaged in, you know, or people that wouldn't have come out to vote for mayor were going to come out to vote for the casino. And that was true. Like, the turnout in East Boston was super high. And people didn't even know who was running for mayor, but they wanted to come out, you know, and make their voices heard to the casino.
Good point. If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, and we're discussing stories you may have missed this week. I'm Callie Crossley, and here with me is Telemundo Boston special correspondent and contributing writer for the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe, Marcella Garcia, and Julio Ricardo Varela, digital producer for Al Jazeera America's The Stream and founder of LatinoRebels.com. So let's move on to where people didn't come out in big numbers, but a big statement was made in Lawrence, Massachusetts.
Bronx guy.
I got to say, Willie Glantigua, you know, he can be down, but he's not out.
No, he's not going to go down easy.
And so there you go. He's separated by 58 votes, the official count as of now. He has called for a recount because it's so close. This was in his fight against Daniel Rivera to be mayor. Daniel Rivera had already claimed victory, but Willie Glantigua, the current mayor, had the option of calling for a recount, and he has done so. Meanwhile, those votes since the election have been guarded by police officers to make sure nobody messes with them. And, you know, we're laughing about it, but there was so much irregularity going on in the September preliminary election that needs to be there, because folks don't know there was some funny stuff going on there.
It makes perfect sense to everyone in Lawrence and beyond that the police is guarding this ballot since, you know, the election day. And you're right. I mean, we're laughing, but it's not a laughing matter, because I guarantee you that a lot of things could have messed this process up, and that could still happen. Again, L'Antigua lost for 58 votes. He hasn't conceded, and he won. The recount is officially happening. So, I mean, to me, what was more, surprising is how Dan Rivera really, like, came out of nowhere.
I called it. I just want to say I called it on Under the Radar earlier
yes,
this year.
You did.
Let's go back to the tape.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah, no, you're right. But...
And why were you so confident of that? Remind people.
I just think people, you know, after a certain point, certain politicians, it becomes the cult of personality. And I think we're in a day and age where people are trying to see or demanding for more transparency from their political leaders. And, you know, with all the things that are happening in the economy and everything, it just kind of boils to saying, you know what, the status quo or the incumbent, I'm not really happy with. And you know, the vision I have about this entire thing right now is that I'm thinking that Geraldo Rivera is going to show up and do, like, this big, like, countdown. It's like the vault, like from when he did the Al Capone, or there's going to be this countdown of, you know, when the recount's going to happen. But you know, I will say one thing about the post, you know, after the election, and I don't know if this is humility, because you always, when you, you know, when you lose in politics, your humility maybe comes out a little bit more. But I will say that, you know, L'Antigua said, it's like, hey, if I lose, I'll concede, you know, and I'll walk away. I mean, I don't think he'll ever walk away. I think he'll probably, you know, I think he'll try to, you know, come back and try to prove that, you know, this was an aberration. But I'm always for new voices. And, you know, there's a part of me that, you know, it's a Puerto Rican guy from the Bronx. I mean, there's not many of us in Massachusetts, so.
He, like you said, he really, like Dan Rivera saw an opportunity. And he, you know, to your point about people getting tired, and he really appealed to a younger crowd. And I think the process.
And that's courageous. It was courageous of him to, like, go, I'm going against the big guy.
And I think the process started, remember the Boston Magazine story, City of the Damned. He was one of the people that led the effort.
Right.
You know, into energizing people and saying, no, you know, we're not City of the Damned, and we're not going to let people label us that way anymore. And so he was a city councilor. The other thing is that he made very, very good relationships with state politicians. Like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, the Senator Elizabeth Warren endorsed him a couple of days before the final.
That was huge.
It was humongous. Huge. Mm-hmm. And people, I don't think people realize how big that was, you know, for him to be getting that endorsement. And the reason why is because he worked in her campaign, you know, and so he already had this relationship with her. And so all these things contributed to him beating L'Antigua Abe for just 58 votes.
You know, I think it's interesting when we're you know, I'm trying to look at the two common themes between these two stories, because I'm looking at it from a Latino politics perspective. And it kind of proves the fact that there are new voices out there, and there are people that are saying, you know what, I'm going to take a shot and I'm going to become politically engaged. I'm all for more diverse Latino candidates in Massachusetts, no matter where. And I'm still convinced that the only person that could have beaten Mayor L'Antigua was a Latino, was somebody else, because it's almost like you have to be, you know, of that world. And good for him for getting the endorsement from Senator Warren.
Yeah. And let me just explain that 74% of residents in Lawrence are Latino, and that Mayor L'Antigua's issues stem back almost from the day that he took office in 2009 and made history, really, as the state's first Latino mayor. And a lot of the folks around him, he's not been charged, but a lot of the folks around him, you know, federal court of bribery, lying to federal agents, obstruction of justice, and a whole lot of conflict of interest everywhere, including taking money from people who work in city government who supported his campaign, which City Councilman Daniel Rivera would not accept money from anybody who was running.
Good for him.
I also want to note that Congresswoman Nikki Sanga supported Daniel Rivera as well. And maybe you have a final comment on, Julio, on this little insert headline on a big piece that they did about this election in the New York Times. It says, an advocate for the people or someone who fosters corruption? That was the question about Willie L'Antigua. How would you respond to that?
You know, first of all, I think I'm already kicked out of Lawrence, like you know, how Marcel is kicked out of East Boston because of my Willie L'Antigua, you know, critique. You know, I come from the school where, you know, public office is public office, and this is public trust. And anyone that you know, if it reeks, and I'm not saying that Mayor Lantigua is, you know, committing major issues here, but anything that smells bad, if it passes a smell test, especially in the political arena, people are tired of public officials benefiting from the public trust. And that game is getting more and more exposed. And I think one of the reasons why it is getting exposed is through things like Facebook and Twitter and social media. People are talking to each other and seeing things. And you have to be really careful more and more. And it's forcing you to being more accountable. You know, I just think that it's part of a larger problem in the political system. And it's something that it's going to take decades probably to change, because we're talking, you know, if everyone remember Lincoln by Steven Spielberg? Hmm. I mean, you know, President Lincoln was making deals. I mean, so this is not something that's new. But I do think that people are starting to actively question public officials. And if you're going to be a public official and elected by the people, you better, you know, you're held to a higher standard. I'm sorry. That's just where I'm
at.
Or
you should be, in any case.
You should be. Exactly.
All right. Let me change topics. Talk about Under the Radar. I found this really fascinating. Marcella, you brought this to our attention. A two-part long series done by The Hill, which is a publication in Washington that looks at congressional goings-on and legislation and lawmakers. How Immigration Died. Now, we've said here that it looked bad early on because there were so many other issues on the administration's plate. And, of course, nobody knew at the time. I think the last time I talked to the two of you that the rollout of the Affordable Care Act was going to be a debacle and take up so much energy. But aside from that, this piece really details what was going on for the last – I didn't know this. I didn't know people were working on this in the House, not mm-hmm. the Senate,
right.
for the last 2 years and how it right. all unraveled. And really what the piece says is it is not happening now. The major people who were part of these negotiations, many of them secret for a long period of time, said it's over. It's not happening. Forget it.
Yeah.
Were you surprised that?
Yeah, it's good stuff. I mean, first of all, I was surprised on many different levels. But the first thing that really surprised me in a very good way is that a publication like The Hill really took the time to delve into, I mean, a two-part series that is very, very comprehensive, and it has interviews with many, many people. It really gives mm-hmm. you a deep look into the background and all the backdoor deals or the conversations that were happening. And it is not a he said, she said type of account. I mean, this is real stuff that was happening. And all of this is needed, you know, to kind of understand how not to do the same mistakes again, right?
And how tough it is.
Exactly.
To get this
exactly.
on the table.
Yes, exactly. So, yes, by all accounts, and it's absolutely dead, immigration reform, which to me makes or means that at the state level, you know, what's going to happen? And here, locally, like, I'm very interested and very curious, and I'm looking into that, you know, how are states yeah. going to respond in the face of federal immigration reform being practically dead and going nowhere. I mean, there's talks that it may, you know, resurface, you know, next year, but not before the summer. But that's not going to it's not going to happen. So what's going to happen is that states are going to start doing, you know, their own legislation, or they're going to try to respond to that either negatively or positively. And I'm looking into what's happening here in Massachusetts, and I'm telling you, all the local advocates and all of the Massachusetts advocacy groups are already, you know, getting ready for battle. So that is going to be very interesting.
So I think that's a really important point, and I want you to respond to that, Julio. But before you do, first, were you surprised by the detail of how these people in the House, I want to make clear, the Gang of Eight that people have heard about was in the
right.
Senate.
Mm-hmm.
This was the
right.
House, you know, very conservative. This is where the Tea Party reside.
Which is where it went to die. Yeah,
here's the thing.
Yeah, but lots of people were working on it who yeah. didn't agree with each other. It was
right.
a bipartisan
right.
effort.
Right.
Go ahead.
First of all, not to say that we called it, but, you know, I've been cynical about this bill ever since the Senate. But here's the thing, a couple of things that I want to add to this. Congressman Luis Gutierrez was on Al Jazeera America yesterday. And if people who know the congressman, he's from Illinois, he's, I would say, the de facto Latino voice on immigration. Very, you know, very progressive, talking about deportations, the reality of the immigration system. he went on and basically said, you know what, we're going to have to do this piecemeal. And you're talking about someone that has perhaps put – his office has probably put in the most blood, sweat, and tears into getting this bill passed. And even he went against the president in a lot of ways. So I didn't see a defeated man yesterday when he was on television. But I did see someone that all of a sudden had to become politically pragmatic again.
So what do you mean by piecemeal, or what did he mean by piecemeal?
What's going to happen is that Speaker Boehner, you know, there's so many things going on. You know, we could talk about this for 3 hours, but there's a lot, you know, Speaker, it's not going to be put up. So what's happened now with the Republicans?
But when you say put up, Speaker Boehner will not bring it to the floor.
Will not bring the, you know, he will not bring a version of the Senate bill to the floor. But what they're talking about. The House bill.
Yes,
yeah, yeah, I'm
yes,
sorry.
Yes.
But what they're trying to do now, the strategy now that I've been talking to people here in the network and other places is that they're going to start looking at piecemeal legislation again. So it's not really a comprehensive package, and there's still going to be a heavy emphasis on enforcement. And you know, there's trade-offs. It's like, well, if you give me enforcement, you know, we'll look at an earned path to citizenship, which, you know, for everyone who listens to all this, it's not like the undocumented of the United States are going to become its citizens tomorrow. This is going to be a laborious process where you have to, you know, pay fees. You have to learn English. You have to take civics classes. It's going to take, you know, for some people, it's going to probably take 7 to 10 years to become, you know, to earn your pathway to citizenship.
But Julio, how is piecemeal going to work even with that?
It's not.
Because in this, in these pieces, what we learned is that a lot of what you're saying now, you give me this, I'll give you that, was on in discussion, in these private discussions.
I think the biggest problem was Diaz-Balart. He's in Florida, the Miami. He's in Miami. The Miami, all of a sudden, like, there was a change. And what's very interesting about all this is that you're seeing progressive immigration rights activists now saying, you know, there's 1,100 deportations happening every day on the Obama administration. It's going to reach 2 million deportations. The Obama administration is going to deport more individuals than any other administration in the history of the United States. That is a fact. And what's happened now is that the progressive immigration rights activists that are saying, you know, we almost had this, are starting to now look at both Democrats and Republicans and say, what's up, guys? Like, what's happening here? You know, I look at the president, 2008, promised immigration reform as a candidate. Jorge Ramos, 2010, grilled him on Univision and said, Mr. President, a promise is a promise. And he didn't do it. And then he comes back in 2012. And Ramos goes, so you broke your promise. And he put the president on the hot seat. The president said, we're going to make this happen. The Latino vote, like, showed up in droves for the president. He gets reelected. And here we are, 2013. And this is not going to get dealt with until after the midterm elections. Mm-hmm. And Latino voters in the United States, and, you know, Marcel and I have talked this so many times, Latino voters in the United States, you know, immigration is the heart issue. This is the issue of the heart, of the soul. And people are like, everyone has let us down. So you're seeing a lot of Latino immigration groups now going after Democrats and the president with sit-ins and protests and, you know, and saying that not more deportations. And it's and what's happened is it's just going to get worse.
Yeah.
I don't see where this strategy is going anymore.
If you're just tuning in, this is Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, and we're discussing the stories you may have missed this week. Right now, we're talking about the immigration legislation apparently dead on arrival. I'm Callie Crossley, and here with me is Telemundo Boston special correspondent and contributing writer for the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe, Marcela Garcia, and Julio Ricardo Varela, digital producer for Al Jazeera America's The Stream and founder of LatinoRebels.com. So let's go back to Marcela's point now, which was in the absence of federal legislations, which we have now discussed in this very fine piece, which I think people should definitely read,
yeah,
done by The Hill, Detailing how much effort and work and time went into the Hill thing, the House proposed legislation, which just died, by the way, like September. Yeah. It's not been that long. And we know what happened on the Senate side, that now states have to step up. The last time we saw states inserting themselves or it's into the whole situation of making laws for themselves was Arizona. And
yeah.
We see what happened there.
Right. Yeah, and that's going to happen again, unfortunately, mm-hmm. because what's the alternative? Recently in California, the Trust Act bill was approved and passed by the state legislature. And
what
approved.
Was that about?
So the trust bill there meant, in very short terms, is that undocumented immigrants are going to be granted a sort of a special permit to drive. License. So mm-hmm. that's what it means. And it also, I think it includes some provisions for secure communities, the program where, federal agents have access to
data. That was a big fight here in Massachusetts.
Right. Yeah, so right. Governor Patrick was
right.
involved in that.
Mm-hmm. So in Connecticut, a Trust Act bill also was passed recently as well. And I believe Florida is considering, and here in Massachusetts, there's a version of that bill too at the local level, the state legislature. It's called the Trust Bill. And again, it tackles secure communities. And it's basically, a cancellation of secure communities because what's happening, we're seeing or people are getting deported on the basis of, having been stopped by a police officer. And that's happening forever and it's still happening. And so those are the people that are getting deported. And then there's also another bill. I think it's called the Safe Driving Bill. That also grants driver's license.
Right. And that's happening.
Immigrants.
What's very interesting, what's going to happen and what you're going to look at states, and this is very simple. Look at the states that have a significant amount, a significant Latino population in the United States and see what's being passed. Mm. Outside of Arizona, which I think is just I think it's sort of like the outlier. You're looking at places like, California
and
Illinois,
Connecticut too. Yeah.
Connecticut. So it's going to be, the fact that Florida is considering it is that's starting to happen. So I think the strategy is going to go back to the state level. I think that's where it's going to, you're going to get some reform and I think it's going to elevate itself again. But I still want to just reiterate the fact that, you fool me once, you fool me twice. And, this is not just a Republican issue. This is not just, let's go after the GOP. There's a lot of people out there right now who are deeply disappointed in what the president has said and done and also what Democratic leadership has done.
So that means Hillary Clinton, should she run, could have an issue with Latino communities.
Well, totally. Luckily for Hillary, she has a strong Latino base. But, people are done hearing because promises were made.
I mean, that's what she needs to start making inroads. Latinos
now.
Love Hillary. They do. But she needs to be prepared for this because there's going to be a backlash for sure. And that's going to be
especially if someone like Christie runs against her. I mean, he got a strong Latino vote in New Jersey.
And so let me point out that he is in favor, the last time I heard, of tuition for undocumented immigrants.
Right. And
state tuition. So
it's going to be very fascinating. This issue is going to be I think it's the hottest topic of the next election cycle.
Okay. Well, we'll be looking forward to it. And I urge people to read this, the Hill report about how this legislation unraveled because it's really shocking and horrible. And there was bipartisanship going on, which just makes me sick that nothing happened.
It really reads like a House of Cards episode.
It
does. The Netflix
show.
It's fascinating.
It depressed me. So I'm
moving
on.
I know.
Right. All right. Now, I want to touch briefly on something that nobody knows about, Julio, which you've written about, which is the vote that Puerto Ricans have taken trying to get to statehood. Or really just to say we don't want to be a commonwealth anymore, which is essentially a colony. Nobody knows about it. Apparently. I mean, it's way under the radar. It was voted in last year, and now there are many, many protests going on where people are angry that the rest of the mainland, I guess, is not paying attention and nothing is happening.
Right, exactly. Last year, there was a plebiscite on Election Day during presidential elections. Just a quick summary, Puerto Ricans basically rejected the colonial status. And, you know, that's a definitive. It gets a little bit murkier about statehood and commonwealth and independence after, but I don't want to really focus on that because people continually put the cart before the horse. What's happening now is, and I wrote a piece for NBC Latino this week, is that people are saying they're trying to look at this more broadly. Let's look at this. How many colonies, we're talking colonies, like the word colony, are in this world? You know, Puerto Rico is known as the last colony of the Western Hemisphere. And what's happened and what's really fascinating, because, you know, I've been covering this for years, is that you're starting to see a lot of young Puerto Ricans, whether they're pro-statehood or pro-independence, working together. You want to talk about this is bipartisanship, like Puerto Rican style, which never happens.
Mm-hmm.
And they're starting to be like, you know what? This is a bigger issue. This is a civil rights issue. This is an American issue. You know, when I ask people, fellow Americans, about Puerto Rico, they know nothing. But when I frame the question about, let's say you're a U.S. veteran and you were told that you can't vote for president of the United States, how does that make you feel? That is the case of many Puerto Ricans who live on the island, who have served this country, who they live in on the island. They cannot vote for president. They do not have voting representation. And I'm not a statehooder, but I look at this from a purely American issue. And what's going to be happening is that conversation is starting to happen in Puerto Rico amongst, you know, people on the mainland. I just had dinner with a really, really good friend of mine a few days ago, who was talking about the fact that about 70% of all Puerto Ricans in the next 2 years, like, they'll be living on the mainland. So there's more Puerto Ricans living in the United States than there are in Puerto Rico, and
without any kind of certain status,
right? And so this is becoming an issue. You know, when you're living on the mainland, I have all the rights. I have all the full rights as an American citizen because Puerto Ricans are American citizens. When I'm living on the island, I don't. Mm-hmm. So
that's why they're leaving.
Yes,
yeah. It's like, but there's a discussion going on more from an equal civil rights issue, and there's a lot of heavy hitters now that are looking at this from a legal perspective, that are looking at this from a how do we present a message and a narrative to the United States that this isn't about, you know, statehood or independence or commonwealth. This is about fellow Americans, 4 million fellow Americans who want to decide, who've said no to a colony, who wanted to finally determine their political status, whether it's independence or statehood. And the status quo is just they're like clinging to the last leaking wall. Like, this is a Berlin Wall moment for Puerto Rico.
Right.
And, you know, if it, like I said in my piece, if immigration is not even like being discussed or resolved, Puerto Rican status, which is all the way on the bottom. And but it's something that I'm seeing my fellow Puerto Ricans talking more and more about it. And we're just going to be like, we have to raise this issue.
Well, then I think when you go to the – I'm ending this conversation because I want to get to something else before we have to close. And that is when you get to protests in the street, I think that'll start to get the attention.
Totally.
So what you've written and the protests in the street, I believe, are going to bring this up, and there'll be some other discussion.
It needs more and more people.
Right. So before I let you two go today, we have to talk about this new proposed – because pop culture says a lot about what's going on in society. This new proposed series – it's not even proposed. It's on its way – called Border Town. Is there a time, or have we gotten to the time, where there can be make fun of immigration, given what we've just had, the kind of discussion we've just had? Just so people know, this is produced by Seth MacFarlane of Family Guy fame. He also did that movie Ted with the teddy bear. He's got that kind of comic sensibility, and you know what Family Guy is like, so it's kind of satirical and a little bit almost vulgar. So that's what's happening. He's gotten a little bit of heat off of him because they hired a guy who is well-respected, Lalo Alcaraz, who's a writer of some note. But still, the point is that there's a character who's supposed to be a modern-day Archie Bunker. And
look,
I don't know.
I think we can make fun of it. And the thing that gives me hope absolutely is the fact that Lalo Alcaraz is involved. Like, this could have been a very different thing for me had it not been for the fact that Lalo Alcaraz is involved. And look, I mean, yes, it's border town. It's stereotypical. But geez, if you've been to the border You know that a border town is so full of stories, so full of it's so intense and it's so deep that it just lends itself. You know, it just has a lot material there for, you know, a movie, a comic strip, you know, a comedic, a sitcom, or even a cartoon like this. I don't have a problem with it being set in a border town or being called, you know, that same thing. When someone like Lalo Alcaraz is involved, because he not only is a respected fellow, you know, he has tons of experience. He's Mexican-American. He's been at it for, you know, as long as I can remember. And he gets it. He really does. Mm. I give the producers a lot of credit for really doing their homework and going after him.
Well, good. Go ahead, Julio. Last word.
Lalo's a dear friend of mine. He's amazing. I love him. My only, and I've told them this, my only concern is that I hope that they give him the opportunity to actually explore that and not just be like, hey, we hired a couple of Mexican Chicano writers and that gives us the justification.
Well, if they don't, you know, he's not going to
do it. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what I'm saying. But it's an opportunity for him. My own personal opinion is I'm not a Seth MacFarlane guy. I mean, my comedy is different.
So I can't say.
Oh, Ted was very funny. It's like, come on. Ted was funny.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah, go ahead. Fine. Yeah. Wrap up.
But my point being is it's like, you know, if we're doing a cartoon about a housing project and we bring in, you know, the top African-American comedy writers, is that going to diffuse it? My comedy is trying to look at different things outside of immigration.
Yep.
I want immigration to go away. Because I think
it's not going away.
I'm just saying it's unfairly defining. It's the one issue that it's constantly like when you say Latino, you say immigration.
Yeah, but
there's so much
more
that we
do. You've got to embrace it to get there.
Well, I will just say this. This is my last line. And that is a lot of people didn't get the joke with Archie Bunker. I worry about that myself, given Seth MacFarlane and all of that. But I hope for the best. So we shall see. Thank you, Marcella and Julio, for joining me this week.
Thank you, Callie.
Thank you, Callie.
Marcella Garcia is a special correspondent at Telemundo Boston and a contributing writer for the Boston Business Journal and the Boston Globe. Julio Ricardo Varela is digital producer for Al Jazeera America's The Stream and founder of LatinaRebels.com. Coming up in Lanyap, our Something Extra segment, we go inside the football locker room to talk racial taunts and bullying. You're listening to Under the Radar. I'm Callie Crossley.